Today we have on Chris. Chris has graduated UT Macomb School of Business. After that, been primarily working in banking with companies like Wells Fargo, PacWest, Bank of California, and you work on their venture team. Are you relying on the growth of the company and the momentum and traction?
We underwrite to the strength of the investor syndicate. That's where a lot of our introductions come from. We underwrite to the strength of the investors. Are they supportive of their portfolio companies? Are they going to step in good times and bad? Are they going to advise them the right way?
Where does venture debt fall in the pipeline? Or is debt always the first preference?
Specifically bank debt.
Yeah.
Because we're heavily regulated, are the cheapest form of capital.
Yeah.
But we're also the most conservative form of capital. And because of that, we put ourselves in a position to be the senior lien holders.
Okay.
We are priority number one to be paid off during a liquidation event.
Okay, cool.
When I first started in 2021, that was still coming out of COVID, where
free
the
money.
Venture capital world blew up and rounds were massive. Companies were being told, like, grow, 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 spin, spin, spin. And then obviously interest rates went up, and that correlates with investment checks going out the door.
Yeah.
That obviously slowed down. I still think at the end of the day, we're still seeing all the right things in terms of year-over-year growth, growing customer account, strong pipeline. I would say that that's due to the fact that, you know, we're a bank.
Yeah.
And so we're always going to be conservative.
Makes
and
sense.
So even during the times of...
Welcome to Funds and Founders. This weekly show is tailored for Austin founders navigating the early stages of their entrepreneurial journey. I'm your host and fellow Austinite, Abhinav Sinha. If you're looking for the motivation and the insight needed to build a successful company, you're in the right place.
Today we have on Chris. Chris has graduated UT Macomb School of Business. After that, been primarily working in banking companies like Wells Fargo, PacWest, which has merged with Bank of California and now Bank of California. And you work on their venture team and deal with a lot of venture debt and supplying venture debt to companies. So welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Why don't you tell the audience what your role at Bank of California is and what your day-to-day looks like?
So I work for Bank of California's venture lending team. And what venture lending is we're providing our debt solutions to VC-backed startups. The value add in this niche of commercial lending is the fact that this is a way for early stage startups to get non-dilutive forms of capital and being able to extend a runway after they've raised a fresh round of equity without having to give up more of their equity on the cap table.
So when does a startup come to you? Do they come right after they raised a round? Does it matter how big the round is? And what's the ideal timeline for someone to come and secure venture debt?
Yeah. So, you know, our first look at a company is right after raising a fresh round of venture capital funding. So our sweet spot is between the seed and Series B stage, but we can go all the way down the alphabet and grow our relationships as those startups get larger. But for the most part, we're getting most of our intros at the seed Series A and Series B stage. The best time to kick off that conversation is pretty close to right after raising that round of equity. And the reasons for that being they come to us, they've received, you know, if they're an early stage company, call it their seed stage, they've received that validation from a VC firm that, you know, this is an investable idea. And this company, you know, is going to be capable of growing.
Yeah. So is this right after raising a round? Is it 6 months after raising a round? Is there a sweet spot of what's the right time to come and secure the line of credit?
Yeah. There's definitely a sweet spot. Typically, I mean, you don't have to close a round and then immediately start, you know, talking to bankers about raising and going through a venture debt process. But we do trail, you know, the VC checks. So there's, you know, typically a 4 or 5 month lag between a company raising their round and them coming to us, usually it being advised by their investors to go and
secure
a venture debt facility.
Does the amount of venture debt change whether I do it within closing a round, a year later, a year and a half later? Or are the venture debt terms correlated to the traction of the company? Does the size of the round matter to the amount of venture debt I can take, or is it more based on MRR, ARR, traction, and those other metrics.
Yeah, I mean, no two deals are the same. I mean, from the point of view of, you know, how much capital do you have need to have raised to be eligible for venture debt? There's no clear answer. There's no metric that we're benchmarking to. But, you know, from a seed stage, our ability to provide our solutions at the seed stage is kind of a pretty recent trend. And I'll tie that to the fact that the past few years, seed rounds themselves have gotten much larger. Yeah. And so, you know, there are seeds today that really look like Series A's 7-8 years ago.
Yeah.
And so, you know, from a seed stage perspective, typically the larger seed rounds from investors that we worked with before are where we can get involved. So maybe a $5 million round that's freshly been raised, we can kind of come in at 1 to 2, 2.5 million.
Got it.
2.5 is on the higher side. I mean, kind of think of, if you do want to calculate it in terms of how large a facility can we put in place, it kind of averages out to about 30 to 40% of the size of the equity round. There's been a few instances a few years ago where VC checks were flying out the door that on the venture debt side, everyone was getting pretty competitive and aggressive that, you know, we've seen our ability to land at about half of what, you know, a facility size, about half of what the round was.
And just to understand sort of why this facility exists, why do banks do this? I'm saying, I want to assume most big banks probably have a venture debt arm or a VC arm. So from the VC side, what I see is, hey, I'm putting $2-3 million into a company. I get some percentage and there's upside and I'm hoping for that 10x, 100x, right? From a bank's point of view, why do banks allow a venture debt facility outside of just interest payments? Is there any other upside for banks? Like, why would a bank do a venture debt facility and what's the reasoning behind that? I'm just curious.
It's interesting. I started my career at Wells Fargo in the middle market banking group, which middle market banking is defined as, you know, companies between 50 million and up to 2 billion in revenue. Yeah. Lots of manufacturers, distributors, essentially all sorts of industries that fall within that realm. And those companies, you know, they have tangible assets. They are cash flowing. There is quantifiable ways that the company themselves can repay debt.
Got it.
And then I come into the venture banking world and it's the exact opposite. All of our customers are cash burning companies.
Yeah.
Raising rounds of capital, burning through that, growing, hitting milestones to be able to raise that next round of capital.
Yeah.
So from a bank's perspective, our inventory, our product is cash, being able to lend. And how do we grow our cash? Will we grow our deposits? And so you look at this space of in the startup world, and these early stage companies are raising $5, $10, $15, $50 million worth of cash. And it's a pretty attractive customer demographic to be able to bring in. You bring in one relationship and it accounts for millions of dollars in deposits.
Got it.
Okay. So it's a deposit driver for a bank. Like I said, as long as we are growing our deposits, we are able to lend in all sorts of areas.
And so to your earlier point, middle market banking, guaranteed cash flow, like relatively low risk debt facilities on that side, right? On the vendor side, company comes in, you extend a line of credit, they don't have to immediately draw on it. But does that risk not affect how many deals you do, how often you do them, how big you do them? Because the more startups fail, you know, 1 in 10 success rate, the lesser chance someone who's drawn on your facility can pay back.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you guys think about that on that from a risk perspective of, are you relying on the growth of the company and sort of the momentum and traction, or do you also evaluate other metrics to sort of make a safe bet?
Yeah, we underwrite to, you know, the strength of the investor syndicate, probably first and foremost. That's where a lot of our introductions come from the relationships we have with, you know, principals and partners at VC firms that we've worked with before, and we've been able to serve their portfolio companies. Yeah. And we have a good working relationship with those connections. And a lot of those intros come from the venture capital firms that we know and are in discussions with, you know, from time to time. And so we underwrite to the strength of the investors. Are they supportive of their portfolio companies? Are they going to, you know, step in good times and bad? Are they going to advise them the right way? And, you know, what's their view on utilizing venture debt?
Yeah.
Are they going to tell their startup to draw on it when it's not a good time to do so? Hopefully not. And so we like working with those VCs that are judiciously advise their companies on utilizing a debt facility. And so that's probably our main metric in terms of understanding the credit risk is that relationship with the VC firms.
Makes sense.
The second thing is the cash itself. How long is that runway? And how are they going to utilize that? You know, what are they going to be spending on? We like to see in an ideal world, say at least 2 years of runway at the beginning of that discussion, because that gives us comfort knowing that there's time for this company to grow. There's time to meet milestones. We've done shorter, but I would say a strong case is about 2 years of runway.
Makes sense. And this is just out of curiosity. Is there ever a situation where you raise venture debt, you extend venture debt to a startup and things aren't looking the best, you're not sort of liking it? Can you ever pull back on that? Can you ever prevent the drawing of that line of credit? Or is that generally not something that happens once a line of credit has been extended?
Yeah, so we typically are able to put covenants in place.
Got it.
And so if a company if they're truly not performing first of all, if they're in violation of a covenant, from a technical standpoint, we can prevent any additional extension of capital. But I would say, we work through situations like that. And I think that's a strong point of our team, is the ability to understand that, level with the company, and, you know, work with them to get through these challenges, whatever that might be. But yeah, there are ways to stop that. But to be quite honest, I mean, our loss rate is, in other banks as well, in this space, is usually actually quite low, which is surprising given that this is a very risky asset class investors to be putting capital into. And by the time a company is coming to us, they've raised that round and there's already kind of that validation.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of trust that the VCs themselves have kind of screened it.
Yeah.
And we're seeing, you know, I wouldn't say best of the best of their deals, but you know, deals that they're confident enough to be able to introduce venture debt.
Makes sense. Again, this is more a learning question for myself, but when you extend venture debt, let's say the founder or startup has actually executed and taken some of the debt, if there's some liquidation event, whether it's a sale, acquisition, whatever, where does venture debt fall in the pipeline of preference? Or is debt always the first preference?
Well, specifically bank debt, because we're heavily regulated, we are the cheapest form of capital, but we're also the most conservative form of capital.
Makes sense.
And because of that, we put ourselves in a position to be the senior lien holders.
Okay, got it.
So we are priority number one to be paid off during a liquidation event.
Okay, cool.
Sometimes we work with venture debt funds that are, call it a non-bank lender, that will partner with us and come in, but they'll be like right behind us.
Okay.
And that's pretty common across
most of the space.
Most of the space, but even lending as a whole.
Yeah.
And to have, you know, the senior lien holder and the junior debt as well.
Okay.
And then obviously the equity holders are the last to be paid.
Segueing into this space, you've been in the Austin space, venture debt space for past couple of years. What have you seen change in Austin? Austin's supposed to be one of the next startup capitals, big growing tech scene. Have you seen any changes just being on this side, seeing deals from the other side? What are the major changes you've seen in the Austin ecosystem, startup VC ecosystem? Is there more or less activity, more or less the same, or what are you seeing?
I would say it's definitely a very active city. It's hard to truly answer this question because, you know, before moving back to Austin, you know, for where I went to school, you know, originally from Houston. So I was living in Houston and I wasn't in the tech scene.
Yeah.
I was in middle market. So yeah, it's hard to say, but obviously, I mean, from the standpoint of, I started at UT in 2013, so that's when I first truly got to live in Austin. And now, 11 years later, the skyline is completely different.
Yeah.
And along with that has been the population growth. So,
yeah.
And the attraction to the startup space that kind of has existed over the years, but has definitely grown a lot since.
Yeah. Oh, I think we were joking about this last night. Every time I drive downtown, I count how many cranes there are.
Yeah.
And I think last night there was 12 cranes that you can see on the Austin skyline.
Yeah, I do the same thing.
How much construction is going on, right?
I do the same thing.
Yeah. I think it's a good thing and a bad thing for the city, because I think the people are growing, but I don't think the city is able to grow the infrastructure at the same rate. And so there's always bottlenecks in terms of traffic, everyday living, options, food options, and everything. So I think that will take a while to settle down, but that's what I've seen. I've been here since 2016. And you can see the visible difference in the amount of activity in the space from before it was cool to be in Austin, and now everyone wants to flock here and do stuff, right? So I think I had Mark Nathan on, and he was saying there's 130 VCs in town. And that seems like a large number. I don't I haven't even heard of that many VCs in Austin. But that tells you that people are trying to set up offices here. I think it'll take a couple of years for that to amalgamate into more startups coming here, bigger funds being raised, and more capital being deployed.
Yeah, absolutely. And that 130 number, it sounds like a lot. And I truly believe it. There's a handful that we work with, but I think at the same time, you could say that the definition of a VC firm can mean a lot of things.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's obviously firms with different theses that we may not necessarily be working with. They may not fit our area of focus.
So having evaluated technology deals over the last 3 to 4 years, are there any trends you've seen on that side of things? Or is there more B2B SaaS, more AI? Going through deal flow, what have you seen over the last couple of years that stands out to you?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, everyone is implementing AI in some form of way and putting it in their pitches.
Yeah.
Not every company is truly building AI, but they're using it in some form of way to be efficient, to differentiate themselves,
yeah,
and to provide a better product. In terms of trends, I think a lot of companies are a lot more conscious with their spending. When I first started in 2021, that was still coming out of COVID, where
free money,
venture capital world blew up. Yeah. And rounds were massive and companies were being told, like, grow, 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 spend, spend, spend. And then obviously interest rates went up, and that correlates with investment checks going out the door.
Yeah.
And that obviously slowed down. And we went through a period of companies starting to downsize,
yeah,
starting to be more conservative with their capital.
Reduce burn.
And so since then, the activity has started to rise again. I would say end of 2022 and a good chunk of 2023, there's a slowdown in investments. But yeah, I think it's obviously picked back up. It's a lot more activity. We're getting a lot of deal flow ourselves, a lot of introductions, and pretty high quality companies as well, which compare that to this time of year last year, or really beginning of last year before the banking crisis. But at the beginning of last year, we were seeing companies come to us that were having difficulties raising, didn't have as much runway.
Then
there were a lot of
extend lifeline.
Yeah, there was.
They could raise them.
Yeah, we passed on a good amount at the beginning of last year, and then obviously the banking crisis happened, and we went through some challenges through that as well. But have come out in a really good position.
Makes sense. So, in 2021, if you saw deals coming across your deck, my understanding of the VC space was you could take a deck and an idea and go raise a $5 million pre-seed or seed round. I don't think that's possible now. I think you need to go with an MVP, a validated idea, maybe some customer traction or some revenue traction to raise the same kind of $5 million seed round that you could have done with a pitch deck in 2021. So for deals that you're seeing on the venture debt side, has there been a similar shift in terms of a company's coming with this amount of traction in 2021? And now is there a change in that in those two parameters. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah. No, I still think at the end of the day, we're still seeing all the right things in terms of year-over-year growth, growing customer account, strong pipeline. Yeah. And I would say that that's due to the fact that, you know, we're a bank.
Yeah.
And so we're always going to be conservative. So even during the times of high volume VC investment, we were obviously getting a lot of deal flow, but we were still being conservative. And, you know, we weren't putting ourselves in challenging situations and, you know, acting like we're in the Wild West of venture capital world.
Makes sense.
From a deal evaluation standpoint.
Wanted to segue a little bit into working with VCs. So you mentioned VCs are a big source of deal flow for you guys, right? For someone listening, an early stage founder or someone who's still raising, just raised, how should they think about their VC relationship? How do you talk to VCs? How do you communicate, stay in touch? Do you have any tips or advice for a founder who's new to the space and new to working with VCs and banks? Are there things you should be doing, things you shouldn't be doing in the communication, asking style, pitch deck style, whatever you have?
Yeah, I would say, you know, put yourself out there and really just start to get to know them on a personal level. They're typically pretty friendly people. Yeah. So, and they are pretty passionate about what they do. So, and, you know, in any line of business, networking is king.
100%.
And so building your network is incredibly important, especially if you're trying to build a company from scratch. Yeah. And are going to have to pitch to investors. And so putting yourself out there, going to events, meeting them either directly or meeting people that can introduce you to them, trying to get in front of them for coffee. I mean, I don't think you have to show up to them and immediately pitch them, you know, on the spot. I don't think that's the best way to do that. I think truly just getting to know them on a personal level and building from there.
Makes sense. How do you build and maintain relationships with the VCs? Is it easier for you on the banking side, or is it a similar challenge on building and setting up those relationships?
You know, my colleagues, my more senior colleagues are, for the most part, the ones, you know, quarterbacking that relationship. But even still, just keeping it casual, reaching out to the associates and principals to get coffee, to grab a drink, to get lunch, and just check in, give them updates on us, and just reach out and touch base from time to time.
Makes sense. One other thing I was curious about is, you're also working with a lot of founders. You're looking at pitch decks. You're interacting with them a decent amount to sort of evaluate the deal, right? Once it comes to you. Have you seen things with early stage founders that they often hesitate with or get wrong in a call, or maybe they do too much of something on a pitch deck or too little? Is there anything that you've seen on that side with first time early stage founders?
I mean, somewhat. For the most part, the decks I see touch on all the right things. Not always the case. No two diligence packages are the same.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes there are founders, call it a repeat founder, who's in a very technical space. And, you know, they've done this before and they can be very technical in their pitch deck.
Yeah.
Because obviously they know it, but they've also done this before.
Yeah.
And they know that already who to reach out to. You know, they're putting this pitch deck together for two people that they have in mind that they know they're going to get a check from and know they understand. So, you know, it varies. There's, for the most part, the common structure of a deck is the same. I think some things that are helpful for us, and specifically my role at the bank, and because I'm doing the underwriting and putting the package together, going into who your competition is, why you're different from what they're doing. How do you differentiate? What's your secret sauce? That's helpful for us from a standpoint of, you know, understanding why is this company unique? Obviously, by the time it's at my desk, it's already received funding. So I don't have to get too philosophical into that. But it's definitely helpful to understand and be able to communicate internally for us, because, you know, we have our credit committee that provides approval and they understand our space. But at the same time, we need to be able to effectively communicate pretty quickly what this company does, why they're different than their competition.
Makes sense. Is there any negotiating on venture debt terms? How much leverage does a founder have, and how much should they use that leverage?
There's absolutely negotiations. I mean, there's so many terms that you could say pick your battles, but there are people that are like, I want to change this, 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 and this. But we're always transparent. And at the same time, it's what's the market offering.
Makes sense.
So they can be seeing term sheets that all kind of fall in the same range of things.
Yeah.
One is better on pricing, but not as friendly on the covenants.
Yeah.
One is no covenants, but it's
more
higher, yeah. You know, pricing. Yeah. So, you know, everything can be negotiated, but we're pretty transparent and open throughout our process. So by the time we are sending the company our term sheet, all the big ticket items, they've already seen, and then they can say, you know, can we tweak this? And that's all before we even get to a point of kicking off the legal agreement.
From a workflow perspective, I raise money, I go get venture debt, and there's a chance I never have to draw on the venture debt, right? Like, maybe that's an ideal scenario. I don't know, like, what's ideal or not in this case. But in that situation, should I be negotiating terms for venture debt, or is it more of a safety net? Or how should a founder think about this? Because I understand why a company does this. I understand why you go get the venture debt. It's a line of credit you can use if you need it. And so on that thought, how should I think about it? How much time should I spend? Because again, find line items going back and forth. It's a lot of like mental space and energy.
Yeah.
So what's your recommendation there from?
It's definitely a nice to have. It is an extra card you can play. It's another weapon in your arsenal. And it's something that, like you said, we don't require our companies to draw on it.
Yeah.
And so the ideal situation is of utilizing venture debt is your company is performing very well. You're hitting your milestones. You may be even ahead of your forecast. And in conjunction with your board, you talk about, hey, let's draw on this facility. Let's kick out our original timeline of going back to the market to raise another round of equity and use this debt to extend our runway and continue to achieve this growth. And then that way, when we do go back to the market to raise that next round of funding, we can be at a higher valuation.
Makes sense. Probably a super edge case. I'm just curious because we're talking about this now. If I raise a round, I raise venture debt, and I raise another round, do you reevaluate the venture debt? Do you extend it? Do you make it a bigger line of credit? How does that work? How often does that happen?
Yeah, I mean, we want our relationships to be long-term.
Yeah.
And so day one at an earlier round, we're providing a size of a facility that makes sense at that time.
Yeah.
2 years later, you've grown, you've raised additional capital. We're going to be able to grow with you.
Makes sense.
And so we can revisit the terms, we can upsize the commitment, extend out the maturity, and again, just grow with that company. And we can scale pretty highly. There's some old t-shirts that my colleagues wear back from when we were Square One Bank that says from garage to IPO. So we pride ourselves in the ability to scale with companies.
Makes sense. And you mentioned this is a way for banks to grow their deposits as well. If I raise venture debt from a bank or Bank of California, do I have to bank with them? And are they now my exclusive banker? Or how does that relationship work?
Yeah, when I started, that was the terms of the deal. If you're going to take our term sheet, our facility, we were going to require you to bank with us. The reasons for that being our pricing is pretty cheap. Bank debt is a pretty cheap form of capital. And for us to maintain that pricing, we need to be growing our deposits, which brings down our cost of capital. That's changed over the past year and a half to the events that happened last year with everyone revisiting banking relationships. So we have started to see, and you know, it's become more norm for requests to say, you know, hey, can we keep X amount of cash outside of bank?
Yeah.
That's typically fine, but the majority of the relationship is going to be with us.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, we have a great treasury management team, a pretty innovative online banking presence. So you can do anything here that you would anywhere else.
Makes sense. Thinking about innovation in banking, there's a bunch of new banks coming up. There's a bunch of neobanks coming up that provide an all-in-one solution. Brex, Mercury, a bunch of neobanks where their whole pitch is, hey, you can do everything from our platform. Banking, accounting, manage credit cards, manage payroll, sort of do a little bit of everything. How does a more traditional bank compete with these new offerings? I'm always inclined to want to take the solution that will solve the most of my problems, right? Mm-hmm. But there's trade-offs. So how do you guys think about it? Is that a point of friction? Is it not a point of friction?
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, we are a chartered bank. We are a regulated bank. We are a bank.
Yeah.
And some of these offerings, you know, are kind of startups themselves, big startups, yeah. But that have their niches in terms of what they 100%. Do and how they provide their services. But at the end of the day, you know, we are a bank. We can do so many more services 100%. That you're going to need to be able to do. From a very, very early stage, it can absolutely make sense to start working with those providers. But as you grow and you scale, I think you're going to very quickly outgrow those services.
Makes sense.
To where you actually do need a true traditional, you know, bank, whatever you want to call it.
Makes sense. This is a random sidebar. So I've done a bunch of banking stuff in India, and what dumbfounds me is country of 1.45 billion people. And payroll is not truly automated. And the reason is accountants are relatively more affordable, right? $100 a month, $200 a month. An accountant comes and does everything for you. And for a country that's doing so much tech innovation on the banking side, I feel like India's pretty behind. They've done some interesting stuff. But like every time I see a neobank in the US, I'm like, this is awesome. Like I want this sort of automation facility, right? But it just doesn't exist on that side in India. And it's been a similar space where traditional bank can do a lot more secure, a lot more government backed, but tech innovation there is just so slow. It just pisses me off. But yeah, that's cool. How do you see the venture debt space growing in the coming years?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I mean, there's already been so many new entrants to our space. You know, banks have gotten pretty interested in it because, again, because of that deposit model.
Yeah.
So competition has gotten pretty fierce in instances where a company wants to do a big process.
Yeah.
You know, we've gone through a process where a company was talking to six banks and two debt funds. And I was like, why are you even spending the time to do that?
Yeah.
And then there's situations where they're only talking to us or they're talking to us to one other person.
Yeah.
And from a next step standpoint, I'm truly not sure. Will more entrants come? I don't know where there will be some sort of consolidation. And not an economist here, but it has definitely been interesting because there has been so many new entrants within the past few years.
Quick differentiation. How does a venture debt fund differ from the venture debt you provide via bank versus I don't know if there's a third option.
Yeah, call it a non-bank. And yes, there's definitely some venture debt funds out there. There's a lot of them.
Yeah.
Their models is different. They can get more comfortable with profiles of companies that we may pass on that, you know, may be going through a challenge or are in a space that isn't really down the middle of the fairway for us. And on the other side of that, they're going to charge a lot more. Their interest rate is going to be a lot higher.
Because they're running it like they want to make money on there.
Because, yeah, at the end of the day, they are investing out of a fund themselves. They have gone to LPs and they need to generate returns. And so working with a non-bank venture debt fund, you know, that is a debt facility that is going to be drawn day one. You know, it has to be drawn on for the economics to work for the
fund. Because if it's never drawn on, they're
not generating any return.
Do you recommend, I mean, you're obviously going to recommend Bank of California's venture debt, but from just the point of view of terms, is it easier to get venture debt fund because maybe they're not as rigorous, not as conservative as maybe a bank or a non-bank, right? Any tips on how someone should evaluate what they should look at to make sure they're making the right decision? And you don't have to say one or the other, just like terms on like, make sure you're looking at this thing and this thing and when comparing non-bank fund versus bank?
They're more so going to a non-bank, probably because it doesn't fit our thesis or our practice.
Okay.
Not that we're turning them away, but at the same time, they can get a pretty good deal at a non-bank fund.
Yeah.
And the treasury management and deposits and the banking relationship doesn't matter for a non-bank fund because they're not a custodian. They're not a bank. You can get, you know, probably access to a larger facility, not that much bigger, but bigger in some instances, probably not as covenant, if a covenant is needed. But again, they're always going to be charging higher. And so it's going to be a more expensive facility. But there are times where it does make sense for that company to go that route, especially if it's a more capital intensive business model that
needs a bunch of cash up
front. Yeah,
makes sense. You've been seeing a lot of deals. What's one thing that excites you personally outside of the providing venture debt space? What's exciting you in this startup ecosystem right now? Any particular kind of company you've seen or space you've seen or idea you've seen that's like, oh, that's pretty cool. I didn't see that before.
Call me boring, but B2B SaaS is pretty straightforward for us.
Yes.
I like a pretty simple business model that I go through and I'm like, man, why didn't I do that?
So I do this segment where I ask every guest to give me a question for a future guest. And so your question is, how big do you want to succeed and why?
Oh, obviously, I want to continue to grow in my current role. Stepping into this space takes time to build that network, build that partnership, and build that trust with the companies we work with and the connections that feed those opportunities. Our senior colleagues, they've been doing this for a long time. They've been able to build strong connections with investors from all over and be able to get fed opportunities and to be able to make introductions for companies to those investors and kind of be a trusted voice to the, you know, the partners at the VC firms that they're making those introductions to. And so, you know, I want to continue developing my role. I want to continue to build my network. And, you know, this is such an interesting space in a very fun city that is has already been growing and is poised to continue to grow. I look forward to the fact of being in, you know, a core industry here in Austin that is going to be a driver of that growth. And so I think over time, I think that's just going to open the door to lots of opportunities.
Quick follow-up there. Are you focusing on your network in Austin? I think you mentioned a deal in Utah.
We're
not Austin agnostic.
Right. And so our tech lending group is split up into three regions. So we have the West Coast, the East Coast, and we make up the Central region. And so we have obviously our Austin office, and then we have an office in Denver with two bankers there. We cover everything from the Rockies to Texas through and throughout the Midwest.
Nice.
And that's kind of our geography that we try to stick to. And
you think that's going to grow over time?
It's not hard these days to reach out to someone in Ohio that receives funding and, you know, be able to get on a Zoom call and kick off a partnership or relationship there. So yeah, so building those geographies or working throughout those geographies, which is pretty exciting because, you know, that means getting to build those you know, like I've done here in Austin, be able to go to Chicago, be able to go to Denver, be able to go to Salt Lake City and, you know, create little hubs, little networks there.
Nice. I like it. What's your question for a future guest?
So when I came into this role, I came from a position where I was an analyst. I was kind of, you know, back office, if you want to call it, to now being customer facing, going out to events and chatting. And I'm a pretty quiet person at heart, but, you know, that took stepping out of my comfort zone a lot.
Yeah.
So I guess my question is, how are you getting comfortable being uncomfortable?
I like it.
Yeah.
Sweet. Well, thank you for coming on, Chris.
Yeah.
I think we had a lot of good insights.
Thank you.
Where can listeners reach out to you, learn more about what you're doing, check out Bank of California?
Yeah, I am on LinkedIn. I mean, message me on LinkedIn. I will respond. I got in my job in this current role from a LinkedIn message myself. So pretty strong user of direct messages there.
Nice.
Feel free to shoot me a message, view my profile.
Great. But thanks for coming on. Let you know when everything's live, but we'll link everything in the description and people reach out.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Abhi.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for tuning into Funds and Founders. If you're a local Austin founder, a venture capitalist, or just someone who's building and in the middle of their journey and would like to be featured on an upcoming episode, submit your guest pitch to abhinavsinha.podcast@gmail.com. If you have a founder-specific event you'd like to promote on the podcast, you can also reach out to me. If you want to continue to get support through your founder journey, hit the follow button and I'll see you in the next episode.